May it please the court, Lisa Banks of Katz Marshall and Banks on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Martin Desmond. With me at council table today are Deborah Katz and Dan Edelman. I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about the motivation of the FBI in terminating Mr. Desmond. There was strong evidence below that the FBI's decision to terminate Mr. Desmond was motivated by his PTSD diagnosis and their own stereotypes regarding this condition, despite information from their own psychologist that Desmond's condition was treatable and that he would make a good agent. For example, there was evidence that the alleged discriminating official, Jeffrey Higginbotham, harbored concerns about Mr. Desmond's PTSD and how it might affect his abilities going forward. But the jury never got to assess this strong evidence of motive because the district court decided as a matter of law that Mr. Desmond wasn't protected by the Rehabilitation Act. The district court ruled that Mr. Desmond failed to present sufficient evidence that he was substantially limited in a major life activity and therefore disabled. However, on this issue, there were material issues of fact for the jury to decide. The evidence was not so one-sided that summary judgment was warranted, and it was improper for the court to rule as a matter of law. Now, in order for the jury to assess the strong evidence related to the FBI's improper motivation, Desmond needed to demonstrate as a threshold matter that he had a disability under the Rehabilitation Act, that is, a physical or mental impairment that substantially limited him in a major life activity. Desmond argued that he was substantially limited in the major life activity of sleeping, and it was undisputed that he had an impairment, PTSD. And the district court determined that sleep is a major life activity. The question then remained.
This circuit's never so held, right?
No, this court has not yet held that it's that sleep is a major life activity. But I think that it's not a difficult leap to make given its central importance to daily life, and indeed it's necessary for survival. The district court found that it was.
Judge Williams suggested in the Haynes case that. The way to think about this is not in terms of sleep being a major life activity, or at least not measured by whether one has difficulty sleeping, but rather by whether it has an impact, presumably on other major life activities, such as working,
mm-hmm.
assuming working is one.
Right. I actually think that looking at it that way creates a standard that doesn't exist, because the question of whether somebody is disabled, substantially limited in a major life activity, is a threshold question of coverage like race or gender. And in order to show that for disability, you need to show you're substantially limited in a major life activity and only that major life activity. There's no suggestion you need to show that it affected day-to-day activities or any other major life activity other than the one you're claiming. And I would give you an example of that.
Some people need a lot of sleep, some people need a little sleep. How do you show that you're impaired with respect to sleep?
You have to show that you're impaired as compared to the average person in the general population.
That doesn't make any sense, because there's a wide distribution in the need for sleep. 7 to 8 hours perhaps or more on one end and 4 or 5 on the other, or perhaps less.
Well, I think it differs for different people and it's an individualized inquiry.
That's the point. Everyone is basically, with a few exceptions, are going to be off the mean. Right? You can't compare them to the mean, because everyone's going to be either above or below.
Well, I think there have been studies done that demonstrate that about 95% of Americans sleep over 5 hours. So I think most people, when you're talking about 2 to 4 hours of sleep, you are substantially limited compared to the average person in the general population. If you have somebody.
That just doesn't follow. You may be. It may well be, but there'd be some indication. You're looking at the input, hours of sleep. Look at the output and show me, you know, the kind of thing that would reflect impairment.
Right. Well, and, you know, that may be, some courts have held that that should be looked at, the effect that it has on the day-to-day life. And in this case, Mr. Desmond was able to show that it did, in fact, have an effect on his day-to-day life.
What was the showing?
The showing was that he was he testified that he was tired all the time. He testified that it caused him to.
His testimony was that he, by the end of the day, was tired, that it didn't affect his performance during his working day, but that he was too tired for social activity in the evening. Social activity, which was part of the program, I guess.
Well, he did pass his classes. Now, he wasn't at the top of his class. He was probably in the middle to lower part of the class, and perhaps if he had gotten more sleep, he would have done better. What he did testify to is that he was tired all day, he had difficulty, he was withdrawn from the environment, which is what the FBI was criticizing him for.
I'm reading from his testimony at 830, page 830, the testimony at page 298 of the deposition transcript. Were there any symptoms while you were at Quantico that interfered with your ability to do what was required of you while you were there? I don't know. I mean, I don't. I know that I was tired a lot. I know that one of the complaints was that I wasn't interacting with people after hours. That may have to do with how tired I was. I don't really know. I think I was still performing at a high level despite these feelings of guilt, despite the sleeplessness. That's his testimony.
Well, he did testify that he was impacted by his lack of sleep. The fact that he was able to work.
His social activities, apparently. But you were able to perform well in all your classes while you were at Quantico, correct? Let's see. I think I did. I mean, as far as I know, I did. I passed everything.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the impact?
The impact is on his sleeplessness being...
No, the impact of his sleeplessness.
The impact of his sleeplessness was that he was tired, he was withdrawn from his classmates. The issue of being withdrawn was something the FBI specifically pointed to as a problem with Desmond. And the fact that he was able to function in his classroom activities, which is tantamount to his work, I mean, we're not talking about the major life activity of working here. So I think that Desmond did make the sufficient showing to show that it did affect his abilities, his daily abilities, if that is in fact the standard.
Well, you're asking the employer for relief, right, and to undertake discharge an obligation imposed by the statute. So presumably it has to have something to do with employment. Right. Can't just be sleep and that's the end of it. It's got to have some relationship to his employment.
Well, it's an issue of coverage. I mean, if you have somebody who's deaf, they're substantially limited in hearing, but they don't need to demonstrate that affects their ability to do their job. It's a threshold issue of coverage, and to get coverage under the statute and to gain the protections of the statute, you need to show that you're substantially limited in a major life activity. Sleeping is one of those. So if you can demonstrate that you only sleep 2 to 4 hours or are otherwise substantially limited, then you gain coverage and protection of the statute. And that is why the employer would have obligations with respect to the employee. So it's no different than other disabilities.
It's not going to get you very far if it doesn't have anything to do with employment, because the relief is a reasonable accommodation, right? I mean, the obligation of the employer is to make a reasonable accommodation. If there's no effect on work, if the deaf person is covered, but it works in an environment where the deafness is absolutely no problem, what's the benefit of that?
Well, reasonable accommodation is only one cause of action under the ADA or the Rehab Act. There's also an obligation not to discriminate. This isn't an accommodation case. This is a discrimination case. And the evidence was such that the FBI took its actions against Desmond because of this PTSD, which we argue rises to the level of a disability. And the court ignored powerful evidence of this motive. For example, Dr. Davis, the FBI's own psychologist, testified that Jeffrey Higginbotham was concerned about Desmond's condition, his PTSD, and how that might affect his abilities going forward. She testified that Higginbotham was looking for psychological tests to determine his suitability and wanted assurances that the treatment would be effective. She also testified that generally at the FBI there's a stigma attached to mental impairments and to PTSD, and that many agents would sneak in to see her and try to hide their symptoms because it was, quote, not accepted. Mr. Higginbotham himself referred to Desmond's condition, PTSD, as potentially a confirmable, diagnosable disability.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume you're right that sleep is a major life activity, and my question is, he says that for 10 months, he slept for less than 5 hours, right? And for half of those, for less than four.
That's right.
Okay. So how do we distinguish, what's the principle by which we would distinguish that situation from someone who has a sleep disorder, but not one that would rise to being a disability? Because that's the judgment that has to be made at summary judgment, right?
Well, I think at summary judgment, you have to look at whether a reasonable juror could find from these facts.
Right.
And there are going to be instances, if somebody's alleging eight or nine.
Suppose it was 6 hours per night, not five.
I think that has to be a question of fact for the jury. But the
summary judgment has to perform some function, right? I mean, suppose it was 6.5.
Well, what the Supreme Court has said in Anderson versus Liberty Lobby is that if the evidence is so one-sided that one party needs to have judgment as a matter of law, you grant summary judgment. Mm-hmm. But the evidence in this case is not so one-sided that a jury couldn't possibly determine that he was substantially limited in sleep. And so it should have gone to a jury, which may have determined that 2 to 4 hours isn't a substantial limitation. But it's very likely they could have or would have.
Now, once it gets to the jury.
Is limitation the word?
Huh? Excuse me?
Substantial limitation, is that?
Yes, it's substantial limitation.
On a major. Now, once it gets to, if it goes to a jury, would the plaintiff have an expert witness who would testify about how much sleep the average person gets? Is that the way you would shape that up?
I think you could have that type of information. I don't think you need that type of information. I think it's akin to a reasonable person standard, I believe, so that it's based on common experience.
But doesn't the jury need some guidance? Everybody has such different experiences.
Well, I think that's what it is to be a jury. You all bring your experiences to bear on a situation. And like I said, it's sort of like the reasonable person standard. It's not clearly defined, but jurors are asked to weigh and give their opinion on that. And similarly, with sleep, it's a common experience that jurors can understand. So while you may put forward that type of evidence to put forward your case, I don't think you need to. And there's certainly no cases or authority that says that you must.
This aspect of the case doesn't turn on any diagnosis of PTSD, though, does it?
Well, only to the extent that he has an impairment. Are you talking about coverage?
The coverage thing. I mean, if he was just an insomniac, your argument would be exactly the same.
Well, if insomnia was determined to be a physical or mental impairment, which is it's a physical or mental disorder.
Instead of sleeping 4 to 5 hours, somebody oversleeps all the time, and as a result of which they're always late for work. They can't be fired for being late?
No, they absolutely can be fired for being late. Number one, you would have to show that their problem related to an impairment. If it doesn't, then disability is not an issue. Similarly, if they keep coming
in. My impairment is that I need more sleep than other people do.
That's not a physiological disorder as defined by the regulations. Mm. So if he came to work late, he could be fired because they also have to be a qualified individual with a disability. So even if you have a disability, if you're not qualified to do your job, and presumably attendance is a requirement of the job, then you wouldn't. The employer would be fine in that situation. Mm.
Did he communicate with anybody other than the psychologist about his inability to sleep?
He talked to initially somebody else at EAP named Tom Lewis. That was the initial diagnosis.
That person wasn't a psychologist.
He was in the EAP system. I don't know whether or not he was a psychologist, but then the FBI officials sent him to Dr. Davis, who specialized in PTSD as related to law enforcement officers.
Is it critical to your case that he communicate his inability to sleep?
I think it's you mean to FBI officials?
Yeah. I thought his argument was that he was doing fine until they learned he had PTSD.
That's right.
And that's when things changed, right?
That's right. Yes. So it was critical that he communicated the PTSD, and he testified he did communicate that to Cochran, and Dr. Davis indicated that she had communicated that to the other FBI officials making the decision or involved in the decision here. So that was important.
Yeah, but there are so many steps. Number one, he had PTSD. Number two, that as a result of that, he lost sleep. That as a result of losing sleep, he was tired at least toward the end of the day. That because he was tired toward the end of the day, he didn't socialize with other FBI agents. And the reason, and the fact that he didn't socialize with FBI agents played a role in the FBI's decision to terminate him. Now, that's a lot of steps, and I'm wondering...
That's the ADA.
Well, I'm wondering how much of that has to be communicated. How's the FBI, if they know he has PTSD, going to come to the conclusion that that's the reason he didn't hang around and socialize at the end of the day?
Dr. Davis told them. I mean, this case is basically, why did the FBI take the action they did? And the evidence shows that once they learned of his PTSD, they acted on their own stereotypes around the condition and took their negative actions against him. And they were told by Dr. Davis that the activities or the actions of Desmond that they were concerned about were because of his PTSD, and that these were symptoms of his PTSD. So they knew full well what they were dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. There are three issues before this court in this case, and the first is whether or not the district court properly granted summary judgment to the FBI on the grounds that appellant was not disabled or perceived as disabled by the FBI. And the second is whether or not the district court properly rejected appellant's attempt to change the number of materially adverse actions that would be sent to the jury. And the third is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in admitting into evidence for a limited purpose the very document that formed the basis of the FBI's decision in this case. And we submit that the record in this case demonstrates the correctness of all three decisions. With respect to appellant's disability, claim of disability, in which he claimed that he was disabled in the major life activity of sleeping, as this court has noted, this court has not determined that sleeping is per se a major life activity.
Is it your position that it's not? Is it the government's position that it isn't?
It's difficult to answer that question in this sense, Judge Tatel, because
well, you have to answer it.
It is our position that it is a major life activity, but you must show an effect. Uh-huh. That under Sutton and Toyota, you must show that your inability to sleep has an effect in some manner on your life.
Where do you find that in the statute?
Well, that's not in the statute, uh-huh. But every case that has looked at the major life activity of sleeping has not adopted a per se rule that if you get less than a certain number of hours of sleep, you are disabled. They have always looked at the effect of the sleeplessness on the individual's work life.
So it's different than other major life activities, right?
Well,
in your view.
I think all major
that's
life.
That's not true for other major life activities.
I think all major life activities show an effect on the person.
Suppose, for example, someone uses a wheelchair. And for whatever reason, that person's able to do his job just fine. It's on the first floor, he doesn't need a ramp, sits at his desk, does his work. No problem. Is that person not limited in a major life activity?
That person is limited in a major life activity
because... And the employer could not fire that person, correct?
That's correct, assuming the person is able with accommodation to do his job.
No. My hypothetical was that he didn't need any reasonable accommodation.
Then you're asking.
You're suggesting that because that person's disability, that is, that person's use of a wheelchair, doesn't affect his work, that he's not limited in a major life activity.
No, I don't mean that it has to affect your work. In fact, the Supreme Court in Toyota made it clear.
That's what you just told me about sleep.
It needs to affect your life in some manner. It could be work. It could be that you fall asleep when you're. It could be that you fall asleep when you're trying to eat, so you can't eat a proper meal. It's got to affect you in some way. You can't simply have a per se rule because
we know. I mean, the literature on sleep is pretty clear that sleeping regenerates memory. It regenerates all kinds of mental abilities that can't function without sleep.
That's correct, and different people have different levels of need with respect to sleep.
No, I'm moving to a different question. That's a different question. If sleep is a major life activity, then the question becomes, is this person substantially limited in it? And that's the question of how he compares to others. But I heard you saying is that you can't even make the decision about whether he's limited in a major life activity without first seeing whether it affects his work.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to imply it has to affect work. I meant to say that it has to affect you in some manner. There has to be some negative effect of this in order to be considered substantially limiting.
You don't think that someone who can't sleep more than 2 to 4 hours for 10 months is going to be limited in his functioning?
Well, two things with that regard. First of all, the record doesn't show it was 2 to 4 hours for 10 months. In fact, the record very clearly shows that it was only for 5 months.
No, the record shows, I think, that it was less than 5 hours for 10 months and less than 4 hours for half of that.
Actually, Your Honor, the record shows that he was getting 3 to 5 hours a night. If you look at the joint appendix at 391, he says that prior to his receiving orders in June of 2000, he was having greater difficulty sleeping than when he was home in Ohio. And then he said prior to his orders, he was sleeping 3 to 5 hours a night. The plaintiff bears the burden of showing what the impairment is. Saying I sleep 3 to 5 hours a night without saying how many nights you sleep 5 hours, which according to appellant in their brief is the norm, they failed to show that he was below the norm.
He didn't say five was the norm.
Actually, I think that in their brief, as I recall, they said that 5 and more hours is what they believe to be the norm, and they cite some cases which cite Washington Post articles on surveys of sleep.
They cited a case where an expert relying on a study that appeared in the Washington Post said that, what was it, 92% sleep more than 5 hours, right? Wasn't that what it was?
My recollection was it was 5 hours or more.
5 hours or more, so.
And I think
he's sleeping less than 92% of the people.
Well, that's unclear. If he's only, there's only a period of 5 months where he says where he testifies he was sleeping 2 to 4 hours.
Why isn't 5 months enough?
Pardon?
Why isn't 5 months enough?
Because it was from the day he received his orders in June of 2000 to November when he resigned. He said during that period he was sleeping only 2 to 4 hours. And I think what is significant and frankly dispositive of this issue is the fact that when he changed his location, his alleged disability changed. And this case, this court's decision in Haynes versus Williams is on point with this. If you can change, if your disability changes when you change the address.
Well, that's not what Haynes said.
Then you don't.
Haynes, in fact, did involve a building, but Haynes specifically distinguished other cases where people had to change their geographic location. They said this isn't like that.
Well, in this particular case,
you're relying on Haynes.
We are relying on Haynes.
Haynes distinguished other cases on the grounds that in those cases, the person had to change his geographic location.
Well, in this situation, it's different than those cases. And the reason is that, frankly, although it was a change in geographic situation, it was also a change in simply the very environment he had. The fact that he was at the academy, that he was given orders to go to a location that he didn't want to go to. As soon as he got out of that situation, his alleged disability seemed to ameliorate. So it wasn't so much that he changed geographic locations and went back to Cleveland as he changed the sort of modus operandi that he had at the academy, which is that you are going to have a placement that he personally didn't want. And when he was removed from that situation, his alleged disability ameliorated. And it simply cannot be that a disability can be found based on the fact that somebody has been given a work assignment that they don't like, and they have a physical reaction to that work assignment. That's really no more and no less what happened here. He was told that he was going to go to a place he didn't want. He started having more significant sleep problems. And as soon as he was able to get out of that situation, his sleep problems ameliorated. That can't be the basis for a finding of a disability. It would simply trivialize the very important intent behind the Rehabilitation Act, which is to find protection for those that are truly disabled.
You're not challenging that he has the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, right?
No, we're not challenging that, but...
And you're not, nor are you challenging that post-traumatic stress disorder can lead to a loss of sleep, right?
Dr. Davis said that it can cause sleep problems. Whether or not those sleep problems rise to the level of an impairment under the Rehabilitation Act, certainly we do not believe was shown here. And I would add in that regard with respect to the PTSD.
Isn't the only question here whether there was enough evidence to go to the jury on that issue?
Well, in order to survive summary judgment...
Isn't that true, though? We're not making the ultimate decision here.
No, but the plaintiff is...
The question is... granting all inferences in plaintiff's favor, right?
That's correct.
Was there enough evidence to go to the jury?
That's correct, and there was not in this case. The plaintiff is required to put forward at the summary judgment stage enough evidence such that a reasonable juror could find in the plaintiff's favor. Mm-hmm. And the record evidence with respect to the sleeping issue is simply insufficient here, as it is with respect to PTSD. The very fact that the plaintiff had, had PTSD is of itself not the end of the analysis, because it's not just the impairment, but it's the effect of the impairment on a major life activity. And while appellant's argument is that he had PTSD and that the FBI had some problems with PTSD, in fact, there is no record evidence that any of the decision makers at the FBI knew what PTSD was in terms of its effect on an individual. The appellant cites to not a single shred of evidence that the FBI was aware that at the time it was making decisions that PTSD could cause various symptoms, that that the FBI had any sort of prejudice towards PTSD. The very fact that Mr. Higginbotham simply wanted to find out more about it does not indicate that the FBI had any particular prejudice against PTSD.
So let's go back to my hypothetical about the person in the wheelchair.
Yes.
If someone alleges they were fired because they use a wheelchair, to survive summary judgment, do they have to show that in addition to there being evidence that the employer knew the person was in a wheelchair, that the employer harbored feelings of discrimination against people in wheelchairs? That is, that people in wheelchairs functioned at lower levels?
Well, if you are discriminating based on a disability, there has to be some sort of evidence that the disability caused the action, that the disability played a part in the decision.
Right. And here he alleges that he told Cochran and then later Trott. Now, they deny it, but he claims, well, he told Cochran and the doctor told Trott that he had PTSD and that after that, everything changed, that his evaluations went from good to bad. And you're saying that that's not enough because there wasn't evidence that the FBI harbored some sort of feeling that people with post-traumatic stress disorder couldn't function?
He has to show that the disability is somehow, that there is an intent to discriminate against him based on the disability.
Right. And what he's done here is he's alleged that they knew he had PTSD, that is a physical or mental impairment. You just told me you're not questioning that. And that everything changed afterwards. Now, what else does he have to show to survive summary judgment?
He has to show that it had a substantial limitation on a major life activity.
Now you're changing subjects on me again.
Part of the analysis.
We already talked about that, but you were telling me earlier, the reason we got into this is you said that the FBI, there's no evidence, he has no evidence that anybody at the FBI harbored any feelings that people with PTSD couldn't do their job. That's what you said, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm wondering
where you get that principle in the law. I gave you the hypothetical of the person in a wheelchair, and I find it. I mean, are you really? Is it really the government's position that if in the hypothetical I gave you, namely, the only fact is that the plaintiff was in a wheelchair, the employer knew it, and the employer fired the person, that case fails because, at summary judgment, because the employer elicited no evidence that the employer harbored discriminatory feelings about people in wheelchairs?
I think you have to have a showing that there's some intent to discriminate based on the disability.
Well, but that comes about through the McDonnell-Douglas analysis. That's what this whole process is about. The question is, has this plaintiff submitted enough evidence to survive summary judgment? And I actually don't know of a case where you have to show to survive summary judgment that the employer harbored feelings of discrimination. I mean, I assume with a case like that, you wouldn't even need the McDonnell-Douglas standard, right? You would just have plain old-fashioned evidence of discriminatory intent. But this isn't that kind of case.
Your Honor, I think, again, with this kind of case, that they have to show not only that he's disabled, but that action was taken based on that disability. And the record in this case simply does not indicate that. I see my time is up. May I conclude?
No, we're going in circles.
And the record in this case simply does not indicate any discriminatory intent on the part of the FBI.
But I thought we were dealing with McDonnell-Douglas here. The question is, maybe I misunderstand the case, but I thought this is the way you had briefed it. That the question is, number one, is there a disability? Number two, was the employer's reasons for firing him non-discriminatory? And number three is, has he shown evidence of pretext, right?
That's correct.
Now, he can win his case without showing evidence of intentional discrimination if he can show that it was pretext for discrimination, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So where in the process, where in that system are you looking for evidence of discriminatory intent? Where do I need to find that? I didn't think we needed it.
Well, I think
McDonnell-Douglas case.
Your Honor, I think that obviously in the entire McDonnell-Douglas analysis, when you're going to the issue of pretext, you're trying to show that
Correct. The
legitimate reason is it was not legitimate and was a pretext for discrimination,
Correct. Which
is an intentional act.
Exactly.
So, but back to with respect to the disability.
Yeah.
In this particular case, we urge the court that the district court correctly concluded that appellant was not disabled based not only on the lack of record evidence as to how his sleeplessness affected his life, but also on the fact that it was not long-term. It was not permanent. That is a requirement of the Rehabilitation Act, and a disability that is affected only when you're in a particular location under a particular set of work directives that changes when you leave simply cannot rise to the level of a disability, and we urge the court to affirm the district court.
Let me ask you one other question. Let me move on to a slightly different part of this case. Assume you're wrong about whether or not this person has a disability and whether or not it affects a major life activity. We then get to the question of pretext, right?
That's correct.
Okay. How do you distinguish this case from our decision in George?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There were so many cases, if the court could remind me.
It's cited at the blue brief, pages 27
and 28. I have a copy
29.
Of it. I'm happy to pull it out, Your Honor. Yeah. But I'm sorry. I'm just not remembering the specific facts of George.
Okay.
Would you like me to pull it out?
No, that's okay.
Okay. I do think, though, that just in answer to your question here, that the district court, in its thorough, lengthy decision, showed why there was no evidence of pretext and why the FBI's legitimate non-discriminatory reason for
terminating. We're reviewing this de novo, and we have to look at the evidence ourselves, but you're not really serious that the reasons the district judge gave here are appropriate. I mean, it's full of giving credence to different witnesses. That's what the district judge said several times. She gave credence to some witnesses. She made credibility determinations throughout the case.
No, actually, she did not. In fact, she used the words, in quote, worthy of credence, because the appellants in their brief had said, in quotes, unworthy of credence, that the FBI's decision, not individuals, but that the FBI's decision was unworthy of credence. And that language is actually found in both in the Reeves case, which talks about a court is supposed to determine whether or not the employer's legitimate non-discriminatory reason is, quote, unworthy of credence. That language comes directly out of Reeves, and there is nothing in the district court's opinion that indicates she was making credibility determinations with respect to individuals. She was looking at the decision and the record evidence that supported that decision and following correctly under the analysis of Reeves and also following the standard that the appellant set forth in his own brief. She found that the FBI's decision was worthy of credence, and therefore there was no evidence of pretext, and it was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the action taken. There's absolutely nothing inappropriate about that particular decision. If there's nothing further from the court.
Thank you, Ms. Bressler.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Banks, give you a couple minutes.
I'd just like to clarify one point. On the issue of Mr. Desmond's impairment or substantial limitation being geographically dependent, it was not. It didn't magically end when he changed locations. It predated his arrival at the academy. It continued while he was at the academy, and it continued after he left. His wife testified that when he would come home from the academy to Ohio to visit, he suffered bouts of insomnia while home. So his severe sleeplessness followed him to a different location.
Well, here's the passage to which Ms. Braswell referred us at 391. Prior to the issuance of orders, I was sleeping an average of 3 to 5 hours per night. Once orders were issued, I began to sleep only 2 to 4 hours each night. Until I returned to Ohio on a permanent basis, I was unable to sleep more than 4 hours each night, frequently less. So he said there was a difference. Now, you're saying, is your claim that his disability, I think I heard you just say, predated his orders here, right?
Right. After the 1997 Hilfiger rapist incident, he testified that he started having anxiety, sleeplessness, nightmares. He didn't clarify.
Any indication that that had any effect on his work? Is it any part of this case? I thought he was performing fine as a financial analyst, well enough that he was deemed suitable for the academy.
That's right.
Right. But at the academy, it's where he falls apart.
Well, I don't think he fell apart. I think the FBI perceived him as falling apart based on their own perceptions.
Yes, he runs into these difficulties with
management. Right, right.
So prior to his going to the academy, there's no problem, right?
Well, there's a problem in his sleeping. There's not necessarily a problem in his working. But again, that brings us back to the same question. His wife also testified that when he left the academy, his sleep problems actually got worse when he returned back to Ohio. So
that's contradicting his statement here. His return to Ohio on a permanent basis.
Well, at best, his statement is ambiguous, but hers is very clear that when he got back home after being terminated, his sleep problems actually increased for some period of time. And so his sleep issues were not related to location or to any work assignments that he was given, but rather to the severe trauma he had suffered and the various triggers along the way that caused those symptoms to flare.
Other questions?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Banks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted.